You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and I'm Eric Clay, your host, and our guest this morning on the Made of Clay Report is Bill Chasen. Bill, welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's good to see you this morning. Now, as we get ready to kind of launch into our conversation and also our music for the day, tell me just a little bit about yourself. What thumbnail sketch could get us started and get people oriented?
Well, people might have seen my name because I'm the managing editor of the Ithaca Times.
Yes.
And so my name's a little more public than most.
Than a lot of names, absolutely.
Luckily, not my face, though. And I've been the managing editor since September, and I was the arts editor for a couple of years before that, and a reporter for a few months before that. Mm-hmm. And then journalism is my second career. Mm-hmm. And I started it in about 10 years ago with the Trumansburg Free Press,
uh-huh.
You know, working for a living. And I was the North reporter, so I covered everything from Romulus to Newfield and wrote for, you know, three different papers.
Right.
And did that, and at some point got it into my head that I would like to make more money and tried technical writing, but I found that it was not, and there was no writing involved, and I was terrible at it. So I lasted 8 months and came back to journalism and started over. And I had become the managing editor of the Finger Lakes community newspapers, but
right.
came back as a reporter,
mm-hmm.
started all over
again. All over again.
So
Wow.
So that's right. that's my
well, that's
second
the
career,
the yeah. recent yeah the recent nutshell of your of
yep.
your of your life. Okay,
yep.
So you brought some music, and we're going to start with Buffalo Springfield, "Expecting to Fly." Do you want to say anything about that song before we listen to it, or do you want to speak
well,
to it later?
Well, this is the kind of thing that people listen to around here.
Uh-huh.
And
so this is your offering
yes.
to bridge the gap or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, and it's actually a kind of beautiful piece of music, really stretched the boundaries of pop music when it came out in the 60s.
Yeah, okay. "Expecting to Fly."
Neil Young, Buffalo Springfield.
If I ever said I loved you.
And that was Buffalo Springfield, Neil Young, and Expecting to Fly. And you want to give a little bit of the history of that song, or the history?
Oh,
of that?
Well, that was just, you know, really highly produced pop music with the strings and everything, and the echo and reverb, and Neil Young wanting to expand the boundaries
of coming out of folk background.
Yeah, true. You know, he came out of the coffee house, and then he was in a band with Rick James, famously, in Toronto, when Rick James was a draft dodger up in Canada, and that was more of a straight rock and roll band. And so Buffalo Springfield was his chance to sort of use the resources of Los Angeles, which was the center of the entertainment business at that point. And he was, you know, he's Neil Young, so he was up to it.
right. Wow. Yes. You came to this area about 10 years ago?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
And so what brought you, I mean, what made this transition important for you in your life?
Well, I lived in Rochester for 12 years before this, and I considered Rochester to be a pretty boring bourgeois place. I mean, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful city. You know, it's got a lot of nice cultural institutions, et cetera. But culturally, it was not what I was used to. And
which was?
Something a little bit more bohemian, living in college towns in bigger cities.
Right. And there's that one little section of Rochester that has that kind of that quality of the village or whatever.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's sort of a layer of Rochester culturally that hangs just outside and above the rest of it. It's populated by, you know, the art crowd from RIT and Visual Studies Workshop.
My nephew was there.
The Eastman School. You know, Eastman House. And that, you know, that's fun. There's good bars and good restaurants and everything. But it's small and it's isolated. So.
Was geology your career then?
I was a teacher at the University of Rochester. I was what is generally called a collegiate professor, meaning that I had teaching responsibilities, but they paid me only half my salary, and I had to raise the other half in grant money.
Oh, I see.
And I had a contract that was renewed from year to year. It wasn't tenure track.
And so it was like worse than even being an adjunct on a whole bunch of, I mean, it's very similar.
They called me an adjunct professor, but it was more than that. You know, I had to go to faculty meetings, and I had, you know, student advisees. And
play well with others, as you
And I was supposed to have a research program and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, when I couldn't raise the money, which was most of the time, it was pretty poorly paid life. And it was getting kind of old, so I figured...
12 years.
Well, I did that for 5 years.
5 years, okay.
Yeah. And before that, I was a postdoc. I had spent a year in California in Santa Cruz. And I was working on my dissertation for a few years in Rochester before that, because I received my degree from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. But I didn't have to be there after a certain amount of time. I was just writing my dissertation. So, and I ran out of grant money in Rochester and actually had to do temp work, which was a real drag. That was kind of a low point.
I mean, and so. The cobbled together life. It's the story of a significant percentage of us here in Tompkins County.
It's common here, And so anyway, Ithaca was my, well, now ex-wife had been from Ithaca. I mean, she had spent most of her 20s here. And liked it a lot and had a lot of friends. We would come down and visit and go to parties, go to musical events and things like that. And it was very appealing, you know, in contrast to Rochester, which was dull.
Right.
And so when I bailed out of academia, we had been already trying to get, you know, jobs down here and to move here. And we came down for Grassroots. And we walked by a bed and breakfast that was for sale. And I said, let's do that, on very much an impulse. And she agreed. And we didn't buy that bed and breakfast, but we bought one in Trumansburg. And it is a long story, but, you know, we did it for 8 years. And it kind of screwed up our relationship. And so... So, you know, I got unmarried, and I'm still here. And And I've lived in Trumansburg, you know, for a while. I was living and working in Trumansburg, and then I switched to the Ithaca Times, started to get to know Ithaca proper, better. And it's fascinating because before I lived here, I was visiting it for a long period. One of my best friends in college was from Cayuga County, and he always treated Ithaca like the Emerald City. And so, you know, it was... He told me about it, you know.
Right.
and when I visited him, you know, I saw what it was like around here, you know, just the surrounding countryside.
Right. Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's very, very different from where I come from. And I grew up in the Hudson Valley and Long Island, so very different. And then I met, you know, my ex-wife, and she told me all about Ithaca in the 1980s. And then I got a job. My first postdoc actually was at the Paleontological Research Institution.
Oh,
so for 6 months, I lived down here half the week and went back and forth between Rochester in the mid-90s. And then I got a quote-unquote real postdoc out at Santa Cruz and went out there to do that. So
I know
I've been sort of, you know, a satellite orbiting through
Ithaca. Right, right. And one of the things that kind of gets lost in this hollowed out economy where we technically have one of the lowest unemployment rate in New York State and have for many years.
Yeah, it's an artifact.
It's false. It's a fake number.
Yeah.
And we have people, we're about 20 years ahead of the rest of the country in terms of the hollowing out of the middle class and middle class folks who cobble together jobs to kind of keep it going. But we have a very significant core of people who are very, very affluent here and a very significant core of people who are hanging on here and the outlying areas where a third of our workforce comes in from.
Yep.
So it's even worse off financially in terms of the economy of the outlying areas.
Yeah, I mean, it's only fair to compare Ithaca to other college towns. I mean, you can't really compare it to other cities of 30,000 or whatever.
Well, it's not. The city of Ithaca proper is 30,000, but the real area is
the county is 100,000.
No, but the built up area is between around 70,000 to 80,000. The contiguous built up area, which includes Ithaca City, town of Ithaca, parts of the village of Lansing, Cayuga Heights, and that's usually what people speak of. Now, legalistically, we do have these boundaries, and they do have serious impacts. But as an organic entity, we're a population of around 75,000 or 80,000.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Right. Yeah, yeah, and so we're.
But most
we're
of them are. A lot of them are students.
Pardon?
A lot of them are students. There's 21,000 students there.
More than that, there are over 30,000,
well,
30 close to 32,000 students.
I'm just counting undergrads. Actually,
undergrads. Yeah, yeah, yeah. About 20, a little over 20,000 undergrads, and about 10,000 grad students.
Yeah.
No, and it makes for a different. But there is a stable population here, predominantly stable population of
small
probably
one,
around
yeah.
60,000. At least,
you know, small.
Yeah. I guess I don't see that as small. Yeah.
That's nobody.
Yeah. It's a small city. It's a small city. We are,
barely.
I mean, in terms, yeah, yeah, no, I know, I know. And what's really kind of funny is that Ithaca tends to be the opposite of wherever people come from. If you come from a major metro area, you see it as rural. If you come from a really rural area, it's a city. No question.
I know.
And statistically, it's one of the smaller metropolitan statistical areas in the U.S., but it's there, and we're ahead of Elmira in terms of New York State. I know, it doesn't say, Elmira was a city that peaked at the Civil War or just before in terms of its growth, and it sat on its laurels for another 50 or 70 years before it really began to decline.
Mm.
But that's the story of most places, is that they're these long-term processes of growth and decline, and we've seen a lot of them in upstate New York.
Well, having an enormous Ivy League university, you know, in your city/town is this enormous buffer. I mean, it makes everything really artificial because you have this pipeline of money coming in from the outside world that is not going to turn off regardless of the economy. And, you know, it slowed down a bit in 2008 when Cornell screwed up their investments. but you know, they resumed business as usual in 2 or 3 years.
And they pared down employment, which hasn't really
risen.
It was
bloated anyway.
Yeah, no, that's exactly, that's part of the point. And that's, that happens. We are the most isolated, largest research university in the United States. By far. Mm-hmm. The only thing, the place that's close would be Penn State, but it's still closer to Pittsburgh and Philly than Ithaca is to New York. Yeah. So it's, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of extraordinary how isolated it is
right,
here.
Right.
Which is part of its charm.
Right. So what, one of the things I like for people to reflect on is, what's a major experience that has kind of helped define who you are, your take on life, what matters to you, what you look for?
Well, that's interesting, because recently he died, Pete Seeger.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Beacon.
Oh, okay.
And my family became active in the Sloop Club, which is local chapter of the Sloop Clearwater.
Right. And it was behind the Hudson River Revival, and there was a person who helped move the Boyce Thompson Institute up to Cornell from Yonkers, Ted Buckley, who was the scientist who did a lot of the early research to document just exactly how bad the Hudson was, that led then to Pete Seeger organizing with that evidence in hand, and they continued to do the work. He got pushed out of Boyce Thompson in a change of focus when it went from being
welcome more to academia.
Right, that's exactly right. but anyway, that's part of the history. And I remember going up there to those concerts.
Oh, really?
And being aware of that in the early 80s. I lived in the Bronx for several years between college and grad school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I grew up in the 70s, and we moved to Beacon, 1971. Mm-hmm. And so Pete at that time would be about my age now. He's in his early 50s.
Wow.
And so very vital, very, you know, spry and fun, and got to know him and Toshi, who passed away just last year, and his wife, and became familiar with sort of devoting your life to serving other people, and not being a servant, but just public service.
Right.
And doing it, you know, with your own agenda, and getting other people to join in, and having that be more important than your own personal advancement.
Right. I mean, he was, my impression, though I did not meet him, though I've known many people who've known him, was that he was such a magnanimous character.
Yep.
That he could legitimately carry a lot of people under his umbrella that wouldn't necessarily have a lot to do with each other, just because of his personality and his history, is the complexity of it all.
Yeah. He accepted, you know, for one thing, he was really fair to his opponents, and that was another thing that
generosity
I learned
from him. Was a big piece.
He was fair. I mean, I don't know if it's generosity, but he was just very fair-minded. You know, when he didn't demonize the people at GE because they dumped PCBs into the river, and he didn't, you know, demonize his opponents, which is very common in politics now and tiresome.
Right. And you're reminding me of a day when fair would have been, and today it would be considered to not demonize, would be generous, because that's the standard.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but you're right. You're absolutely right. Fair is the better word.
And so I learned, you know, just a lot of good habits and, you know, ethics from him. And, you know, I went off and studied biology in college and, you know, worked for my first job out of college was to be an island manager taking care in a state park in Boston Harbor. And then I went to work for Greenpeace for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I would say he's responsible, at least in part, for that.
Right. And did you stay in touch with him, or was he more like a figure
who
helped to shape your life?
When I left home, I left home.
Right.
And I didn't go home. And so, you know, I saw him a few times down through the years. I went to the revival, you know, and tracked him down and said hello. And he remembered me, of course. But I had actually disappointed him by leaving. And he didn't finish college. He didn't really seem to have a lot of views for it. And he wanted me to be a captain of the Woody Guthrie, which is one of the scaled down versions of the Clearwater.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I didn't want to do that. I wanted to go off and do my academic thing. So, you know, he just refocused on somebody else who wanted to do something there in Beacon. And I was just gone.
Right. And
which
I guess
is fair, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's fair, but it's also
Toshi remembered me though.
Right, right. And it's a challenge for those of us who have an activist bent, to be able to bless. Pardon?
You meet a lot of people.
You meet a lot of people, but also the what I didn't sense about him was that he didn't bless you. I mean, you can have, and this is where your use of the term fair was better than my generous, because if he were generous, then you send people wherever they need to go, because they will, if they are working on what really moves them,
going
to find
point,
a place to be, and that's often a sign of being less than. Open to how people learn and grow and change, and where they can really throw the weight of their energy. And we need people who can throw the weight of their energy into issues and not just do what somebody wants them to do.
No, what's interesting about the blessing, I mean, I wouldn't want to have been blessed. I don't like being blessed by anyone.
What is that? Well, I guess, what does it mean to you? Because I think we may mean different
things. People are showing
their
approval. So...
That's one meaning, but it has many other meanings. One of them is go do the best you can, however you can. I don't have to approve of you, but I am sending you to go and do the things that you were made to do.
I don't trust anyone to judge me like
right.
that.
Well, the thing is that we all do. And we are all making assessments of each other, and that's just kind of the nature of life. And I think sometimes it's helpful to be up front, not because they control you, but because you know exactly where you stand and there's no second guessing.
Well, I would hate to think that my blessing mattered to anyone.
Well, I would like to think that it does. And with your role in the community, by what you publish and what you put out there, it is a manifestation of what you bless as news.
And that
matters deeply. Matters very deeply what we talk about and what we know.
I try to get people to think for themselves.
Yeah, but then the blessing can be that and not coercive, and that's when it's good.
Mm-hmm.
When it's coercive, it's everything that you reacted to.
Yeah, it's not a popular way of doing things around here.
Right, right. It is what needs to happen when you pass off leadership from one group to another, because it makes the history clear, and it also makes it possible for people to just do what they want to, but also be honest about where they've come from. And that's really important, because we have a lot of amnesia in this culture across the political spectrum on the good and the bad that we've all done to each other. And we need to remember that and not be tied up in knots about it, not to repeat it, not to hang out with these things, but to, in some sense, acknowledge it and move on.
And take responsibility.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. So let's take another music break, and we're going to go to Roxy Music.
Roxy Music, yeah.
And do the Strang. Do you want to?
Do the Strand.
Do the Strand. Okay.
Yeah, that's, it's a dance, I think.
The Strand. Okay. The Strand. If I could write, it would be good. Okay. And do you want to say something before or after?
Well, the friend that I mentioned who introduced me to the concept of Ithaca also introduced me to Roxy Music.
Yeah.
Because back in the day, Roxy Music was very... very popular in this town in the 70s.
Yes, yes. And this was the fellow from Cayuga County?
Yep, from Venice Center.
Yeah.
There's a new sensation, a fabulous creation, a danceable solution to teenage revolution. Do the Strand, love, when you feel love. That's why we say, do the Strand. Do it on the tables,
quackly whose place on Mabel's. Slow and gentle, sentimental, all style served here. Louis says he prefers laissez faire au strand. Tired of the tango, fed up with fandango.
And that was Roxy Music and Do the Strand.
Yeah.
And our guest on this hour is Bill Chasen. And Bill, you're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and I try to remember to do that, except I do forget off and on, but we're at the half hour. So, anyway, so Bill, you have come into the community radio fold. You've been doing radio, you said, for a,
since 1989.
Yeah. And
grad school.
Wow. What got you started in radio?
Well, I always loved listening to the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my father loved the radio. And he was a salesman, and he spent a lot of time driving around listening to the radio.
Wow.
On, you know, the car set.
Right.
And it was AM radio back in the 60s. And, you know, like Cousin Bruce Morrow and WNEW in New York, mm-hmm, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that was really old-fashioned radio, where they talked a lot and had contests, and they were just personalities on the air.
Right.
And they played music, too. And then when I was in the 70s, I started listening to Imus, Don Imus.
Uh-huh.
Yep. He was on WNBC.
Dan Imus in the morning.
Yeah, so I could go through and list like all these radio touchstones. You know, mm-hmm. It was always just important because I love music. And when I got to college, I went to St. Lawrence University, which didn't have a rock and roll station. They had an NPR station, actually. But Potsdam and, not Potsdam, but Clarkson in Potsdam mm-hmm, mm-hmm. had a great college radio station. And the people that I, you know, got to know in college, a lot of them had come from places with great radio stations. And so they brought all their record collections that were the products of these radio stations together and introduced me to Roxy Music
right.
when I was a freshman that I had never heard. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you know, when I started college in 1978, immediately before the demise of punk. Mm-hmm. And so they had all listened to punk and I hadn't really heard punk. And when it died, post-punk was already beginning.
Right.
Bands like Susie and the Banshees and The Cure and Echo and the Bunnymen, Teardrop Explodes, all those bands. And so, you know, radio was used to be the way that you played music and everyone listened to it mm-hmm. and decided mm-hmm. whether or not it was any good. And college radio was just this separate entity mm-hmm. through the late 70s and through the 80s. And, you know, I never got involved with it when I lived in Boston, although there are a lot of really great college stations in Boston, of course. But when I got to New York, I started listening to WFMU, which is out of East Orange at that point, and heard independent freeform radio for the first time, where it was just mayhem on the air.
What is freeform radio?
Well, sometimes they would play like several records at the same time, and you know, it was just like
over each other.
It was like improv sound.
Wow. Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And lo-fi music was very big at that time, you know, in the mid 80s, and so they were playing cassette tapes that were mailed to them from people who had made them with like Casio toys and all manner of music. And some of the DJs were just really sharp and really funny. Mm-hmm. And it would get downright strange.
Full contact sport sounds like it was, way of entertainment.
It was radio as art.
Yeah.
You know, and it was really a revelation. And that's when I actually heard Nicholas Hill, who's mm-hmm. the program director here. I heard him on the air. He had a show with Laura Cantrell. And his was one of the more straight and sober mm-hmm. shows of that era. But when I got to UMass to do my PhD, I decided I got to do this. Mm-hmm. So I got involved with the radio station there and got trained. And it was the very beginning of the CD era. We had one CD player and three turntables, which tells you everything.
Right.
And actually had a cassette player.
Yes. Yes.
And there was a great record collection there. And it was what they call band programming. So, you know, from 10 to 12, you know, 5 days a week, it would always be a blues show.
Different hosts, but
from
blues
12,
show.
Yeah, from yeah. 12 to 2, it would always be jazz.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then, you know, it's like, just went like that.
Uh-huh.
So it was reliable. And they had to fill those slots. So when you got trained, the first thing you did was go on really late at night so you could screw up and hardly anyone would care.
Right.
And then they would assign you to something that was basically outside your wheelhouse. And so you just had to learn.
How to do it.
And so I learned the blues.
Wow.
And which I didn't know anything about and still don't really like. Hmm. And but I learned the performers that I did like and why I liked them and the different regional sounds and everything. So it's kind of an education as well.
What do you do with your shows on WRFI?
Well, the Dark Parade is named after a CompSat Angels tune. And the CompSat Angels are a post-punk band.
Mm-hmm.
And they so my show started out as a post-punk show, playing, you know, music from the late 70s and through the 80s and the sort of, you know, descendants of that eclectic take on music. But I've since just broadened it into playing freak folk and anything that I like is mm-hmm. basically mm-hmm. how it mm-hmm. goes.
Right.
And I don't plan it at all. I just fill up a bag full of CDs and record albums and go in there and
see just, how it fits.
You know, whatever I'm playing is going to inspire the next cut.
Right.
Right. And, you know, sometimes it'll be thematic. Sometimes it'll just be sonically similar. And sometimes it's just fun to just sort of take the tempo and down very slowly and then build it back up again. And you just texture the show for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And so that's the Dark Parade.
Cool. So, and when does that air?
That's 9 to 11 on Tuesdays.
On Tuesday evenings, 9 to 11.
And then the other one is a talk show. And Nicholas wanted to get some locally produced talk shows. So he's like, Bill, can you do a talk show? And I said, sure, I can talk about natural history. He said, sold. And so I revived a title that I used to have for a column that I wrote for the Trumansburg Free Press, Land and People. And it's about the relationship of, you know, of people with the land. Mm-hmm. And so I have guests that talk about natural history, the natural sciences, stewardship of the land, mm-hmm. The arts that, you know, either take as their inspiration, the mm-hmm. you know, nature as a subject or sometimes as an object. Mm-hmm. I had Fernando Llosa on, and he actually, you know, builds bas-relief sculptures with the local rocks. Mm-hmm. And so, you know.
No, and they're beautiful.
Yeah. 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 They're in Mockingbird Potpourri, if you want to see them.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah. That's the other show, The Landed People. That's on Thursday from 4 to 5.
Wow. Wow.
And on the first day of spring, all I did was read San County Almanac.
Uh-huh.
And alternate it with Hungarian folk music.
So you're having fun. So WRFR is community radio where we are looking for people to take on shows and do
something interesting.
Right, and have fun. And because that shows mm-hmm. in terms of the crispness of what you do and the crispness of your ideas and your selections for music. Lands and Peoples. Land and People was your title. I grew up in a household, in a two-bedroom household with six siblings, and we had
not much land.
We had two sets of encyclopedias and a book called and a set of books called, I believe it was Lands and Peoples.
Oh,
and
geography.
It was I think from the 1940s. It could have been mm-hmm. older than that.
Yeah,
but
maybe.
They're very primitive, some color prints, very primitive color printing.
Yeah.
But we read these things because we didn't have a lot.
I grew up with that stuff
it was a constant part of our lives. And everything we could learn about people from different places. And this was out in 70 miles. The nearest, you know, when I was in high school, the nearest occupied farm was a mile away. I mean, it was isolated.
Wow.
Rural. I mean, I know what it's like to be really, really
rural. Really rural.
And then, but anyway, so yeah, that was an introduction to there's a lot out there that you haven't yet seen. And that sounds like your show too.
I mean, I actually try to keep the focus local.
Yeah, but there's a lot here
that
we haven't seen. I mean, that's the other side is that.
Well, that's what the whole fracking thing brought out to me. Hmm. That, you know, until people started thinking that it was going to change, nobody seemed to know anything about the nature around here.
Right.
I mean, it was shocking to me. You know, people didn't know how groundwater worked and didn't know, about the fact that there's been industry here for 150 years and it's not clean.
And more. Yeah. Yeah. And the fact that all of this was clear cut and it was badly eroded.
Recovered.
And it recovered from the, you know, when the automobile basically drove horses out of, this land was for hay production that was sent to New York City and Buffalo on the Erie Canal. And when the hay gave way, we tried to have dairy. We tried to have poultry. That's why dairy is so strong in New York State, is that it tried to get these farmers back into production or keep them in production.
Poor dairy farmers. Yeah. Jesus.
But it's
don't get me
so
going
we don't
on dairy.
We don't we don't know our history, and this is good.
Well, that's good. Yeah. And when I was working for the Finger Lakes community newspapers, that was a big part of what I did was interview farmers and talk mm-hmm. to them about farming,
mm-hmm.
and also write historical pieces when I could, when I found any excuse. The Backbone Ridge History Group up there in Interlaken is kind of where they're based.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They're exploring the former rural community that was along that ridge
between
Seneca and Cayuga Lakes.
Right.
And they were booted out of there by the federal government in the 30s. And that's why the National Forest is there.
Huh.
And an archaeologist up there has recently, you know, disputed that the farms were failing. That's what everyone was told, is like, you're farming incorrectly, you're ruining the land, get out of here.
Right.
And so she's actually going in there and looking at the place as an archaeological site.
Right.
And she's finding a lot of evidence that these were very prosperous farms. And you know, there really isn't a lot of evidence that there's anything wrong up there. So it's kind of a mystery.
Is this the backbone ridge that June Szabo did a carving of?
Yes.
It's a beautiful piece.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I think that one's in, that one's in Two Goats.
Huh.
It's up on the wall in Two Goats. It's big.
Yeah. It's beautiful pieces. And is that the one where the water flows in opposite directions around the as it comes off the top?
There's drainages are a little weird up there. That's one of her fascinations.
I used to do a creativity class, and June was one of the participants where we would take ideas and we would.
She's really something. She's one of my favorite people to interview.
Yeah.
Because she always starts out saying, "I'm not very good at talking about this."
Yeah.
And then she proceeds to be really good at talking.
That's exactly about right. That's exactly right.
It's
that's
great.
Exactly right. Right. So we're going to take another musical break.
Okay.
And Echo and the Bunnymen.
Yeah,
Heaven Up Here.
Great post-punk band. Yeah.
And
from Liverpool.
Over the Wall.
Mm.
Yeah, that right?
Sonically great, yeah.
Okay. Here we go.
Just
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Bill Chasen. And Bill, it's good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Bill, I want to change up our questions here a little bit. As a journalist and also as a, I mean, you're a geologist too, and
yep.
That's kind of, you don't get much of a longer time frame than the time frame of a geologist.
No, until you talk to astrophysicists.
There had to be a comeback.
Yeah.
But as a journalist, you see a lot of stuff come across your desk every day, every week.
Yes.
So it can be, I imagine that you have to kind of just edit out stuff really fast.
Yep.
In terms of what you're willing to spend time with.
Decisions.
So how have you, what have you learned that's forced you to change a commitment that you had in the past, or how have you grown suspicious of what you once held as a strong commitment? You know, how have you changed? How have you become more deeply the same over the years? These are questions that get at, you know, just kind of what.
Well, I guess as a scientist,
how do you evolve?
You know, I pursued the sciences in order to discipline my thinking,
mm-hmm.
and to embrace rationality as a mm-hmm. primary tool.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, when you're in journalism, you don't see a whole lot of that.
Right.
People just have their passions and they go with them. And
right.
They cherry pick information to build a case for their point of view. And then they're 100% convinced that they're right.
Right, right.
And everybody else is all wet. And I see just a lot of that.
Right.
And I've had to sort of accept that fact.
And yeah.
Give them a voice.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't really help but moderate it. And moderate it as, like, be a moderator.
Right.
And comment on it. Which has upset some people, but there's a tradition of journalism of doing that.
Right.
And, you know, it's one that I'm familiar with and that I'm, imitating, I suppose.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I'm just mellowing, I guess.
Right.
And not insisting that people be reasonable all the time, because that's just...
Right. Well, also...
They're just not going to be.
Reason is, come let us reason together is the term.
Is that Unitarianism?
No. It was one of the ways of translating the message in the story of the creation stories around the serpent and Eve's conversation. Come, okay. Let us reason together.
Okay.
Reason is a wily sort of thing, and a subtle sort of thing. And
we wouldn't be anywhere without it.
We wouldn't be anywhere without it. We wouldn't be anywhere without emotion. We wouldn't be anywhere without bodies. And one of the things that the saws that I have used is that if it doesn't make it needs to have intellectual accuracy, emotional honesty, and it needs to be physically compelling. And if it fails on any one of those three, something's probably not quite right about it, because it needs to, all of those threes need to line up for us, for communication to have integrity. And we're human beings, so we're physical bodies, we're emotional, we're intellectual, and if you get all of those three things to line up, you can pretty much bank on what's happening.
Yeah,
but if you're relying on one of them too much, you're probably being messed with, and somebody's probably messing with you.
The thing that sets us apart from all other creatures is reason.
Not all other creatures. I think you'd have a hard time with some of the primates and some of the birds and stuff like that. I mean, in terms of, you can infer, they're not going to have language.
I don't remember the last time chimpanzees built a subway.
No, not to that degree, but...
Yeah, that's what I mean.
So, but we've also built wonderful artifacts to what works, as well as wonderful follies and things that... Like
yep.
the Titanic that sank on its first maiden voyage.
Yep.
So it's, you know, we reason is a mixed blessing.
But we
have to work with it. Yeah, we have to work with it. It's who we are.
Yeah. And being mortal is a mixed blessing.
That's kind of my point. And one of the things is that the more we're aware of our humanity, the better our communication can get, because I think it forces us to greater honesty.
Well, you have to define what humanity is first. So.
Yeah, and for me, it's that wholeness.
Yeah,
and that's right. That's that. It's not being in a particular way, but it's being in some sense complete or whole.
I love the fact that it's snowing really hard.
Yeah, it's been snowing off and on all morning.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
I know.
It's, well, tell me, the other thing that I like to ask people, especially towards the end of the hour, is what is it that you do to kind of restore yourself? What it is you do to kind of get your attitude, you know, back in shape? What do you do?
I go out into nature.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's the most restorative thing for me.
And by out into nature, what does that mean?
Just go for a walk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just about anywhere. I mean, I could actually, like last night I was coming home from the chapter house,
mm-hmm.
and I heard the geese,
mm-hmm.
and they were snow geese, which are my favorites.
Yes, and so I saw them yesterday on the lake flying north.
And so just that's restorative.
Yeah.
Anything right. like that, where you just look up and there they are. And, you know, you're just here we are on the planet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, what I need.
And do you do that on a daily basis?
Not a daily basis, no.
Yeah. No?
No.
No.
Well, I mean, to some degree, I suppose. Just walking the dog is restorative in that sense.
Right. And one
it's going to be done daily.
Well, yeah, and multiple times a day. And that's one of the things that I, because a lot of times we don't think consciously or critically about what we do to restore ourselves, but it's a big part of our lives, and making choices about it is one of the things that I hope to cultivate with this show, is that people will become more aware of.
Well, the most restorative thing for me is to take a walk in a landscape where there are signs that people have been there,
mm-hmm.
but either they're gone, or you know they're not dominating it, or they've done something that isn't disastrous.
Because so you I like know to, that you I like visited, to read the landscape.
Well, I visited pristine wilderness, and mm-hmm. I don't really like it.
Uh-huh. Why?
Yeah, it's too delicate. You feel like an intruder. You just leave it alone.
Right.
And, you know,
it's so tightly integrated.
Yeah,
if
and
you
it's
touch
just,
anything, it's off.
Yeah. It's just like, don't really feel like I have a place there. There's no
uh-huh.
purpose for me.
Uh-huh.
You know, and just being there and being a spectator, I hate that.
So you would much prefer this kind of post-industrial, post-agriculture landscape of this region to a more pristine forest.
Yeah.
And what does it bring out in you?
Peace. I mean, just feel like, okay, here we are. So and here we have been and here we will be.
Right. And it's not all pretty, but it's not all bad.
No, it's just what it is.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It's not a fantasy. It's what it is.
Right.
Because wilderness is a fantasy.
In a certain sense, yeah. And one of my guests is a field biologist, and he was saying that the only place in the world where human beings and large mammals have really evolved next to each other is in Africa. And other places we had weapons and stuff that basically we wiped out the large animal populations. But in Africa, they kind of until the centuries relatively recent, you know, ability mm-hmm. to wipe out whole populations, we didn't. We had to kind of find a way to coexist. And so humans were part of that. It was never pristine. It was always kind of messy, especially because you weren't necessarily the top predator, the top, you know. Environment or
I would
influence.
Argue with that, but okay.
Sure. Okay. What would you say? Yeah.
Well, I mean, the reason that the megafauna were wiped out in North America is because there were no people here when those animals evolved, whereas in Africa they evolved together.
And well, that was his point. That
and
his
so
point.
The reason that they got wiped out was people arrived here and they were like, what the hell is that two-legged thing over there? And boom, they were dead.
Yeah. And that was essentially
his point.
That was his point. They had the ability to wipe them out. They wiped them out. Whereas in Africa, they never had the upper hand.
The animals were too smart.
Right. Yeah, they never had the upper hand.
Everybody had the same ability, but, you know, the animals had
evolved with the humans. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. That's the point. We're going to go to your closing piece,
The Psychedelic Furs.
Yes.
My favorite band back in the day.
And why?
Because they were so tired of it all. They hated pretense.
Mm-hmm.
And really had a hilarious way of making fun of it,
mm-hmm.
of being sort of snarly but funny. And the music was also beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it had this sort of elegiac feel. And so it was just like an expression of sort of sadness and humor and like, you know, a society that was just on the downside, you know, on the downslope, but that's how it's always been.
Right.
And so the one that I picked actually is from, I think, their last album. And it's a more personal song, but it's very pretty.
Mm-hmm.
And in the beginning, they were young and political. And then they tended to be more personal as they sort of ended their career.
And that's not an unusual track for people's lives, including yours becoming more reflective and, and more patient.
And Richard Butler, the singer, now lives in my hometown of Beacon.
Oh, really?
Yes, he's a painter.
Huh.
And Beacon has become an art colony.
Yeah. It was my daughter lived there for a year, a couple of years ago when she was doing an AmeriCorps stint.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Still one of those places, too.
Yeah. So cool. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and Bill Chasen has been our guest for this hour, and we're going to close out. It's been good to have you. Until She Comes, The Psychedelic Furs.
Comes out, the night shines.